All right, that works. Okay, this is Christy Balchels. I'm the executive director, and I'm going to introduce Margaret Clem. Margaret is a nurse practitioner who has worked closely with Dr. Mark Corson at the Tufts New England Medical Center Metabolic Clinic. And Margaret, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll move on into our topic for today, which is exercise.
Okay, I'm the nurse practitioner, as Christy said, in the metabolic program at New England Medical Center, and I've worked in this field since 1991. In 1991, we had maybe 5 or 10 patients with mitochondrial disease, and now we have many, many more. We became in looking at the best ways to treat and optimize patients with mitochondrial disease day-to-day life. We've looked at exercise more closely over the past year to determine what's the best way to advise patients who have exercise intolerance. And so Christy asked me to speak to you today in regards to some of the recommendations that we've been making to patients based on some of the research that's been done in the field over the past 5 or 6 years.
So, and I'd like to mention also that Margaret is one of the reasons that MitoAction exists. Margaret was instrumental in forming this organization 3.5 years ago, and so we can all be very grateful to her for not only being a practicing clinician, but having the insight to see that there really needed to be a place that was dedicated solely to the education and support and advocacy for people with mitochondrial disease. And Margaret was really instrumental in making MitoAction happen, and she's a member of our medical advisory committee as well. So thank you, Margaret, publicly for doing that.
Thank you. I also have
some a couple of the more recent papers that we'll reference today. For the average person, they're probably going to be too scientific to really be useful for you, and I will summarize what we talked about today in more of a newsletter fashion kind of summary, but if you have this burning desire to read the article that we're going to, the couple of articles we're going to reference that were published in 2007, send me an email, director@mitoaction.org, and I can share those with you. Okay? So, Margaret, I'm going to hand it over to you, and I'm going to ask folks that we're going to let Margaret just discuss the topic, and then as we have questions, if you'll just jot down your question and keep it in your mind, and then we will all help to field some questions at the end after she gives us a chance to kind of get us started on the topic, okay? Works for everybody? Great. Okay, Margaret, go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. As Christy mentioned, the literature that supports exercise tolerance. Oh, I keep hearing an echo.
Yeah, I keep going, Margaret. Let's see if it gets better.
I feel like I'm talking to myself. The research that pretty much started in the early 2000s regarding exercise intolerance in mitochondrial disease is very scientific, and so what I've done, tried to do, is kind of extrapolate from that kind of information that can be meaningful to people on a day-to-day life with mitochondrial disease, and try to make recommendations based on the research and the scientific part, but to make it understandable to people that don't have a scientific background. So we know that patients, both children and adults, with mitochondrial disease have significant exercise intolerance, and it's sort of one of the hallmarks of the disease. And patients complain of fatigue with even basic routine activities, weakness, shortness of breath, rapid heartbeats, the need for more fluids, oxygen, and carbohydrates, whether it's in the form of eating or requiring more dextrose through an IV after or before participating in any kind of activity, whether it's from light housekeeping to taking a walk to more significant activity levels. So the question has come up many, many times through the years as to whether it's whether to recommend a more sedentary lifestyle or to encourage patients to exercise. And in the past, we generally recommended that people pace their routine with a very low level of activity. And over the years, more research has been done, and it started really looking at the average person who exercised. And they looked at mitochondria in the patients without mitochondrial disease who exercised and found that they actually had higher numbers of mitochondria in their muscle cells, and the mitochondria were healthier in patients that in individuals that exercise. These are just people in the general population. And so that information was kind of taken to the mitochondrial patient population and looked at as to what the benefits or contraindications of exercise would be in patients with mitochondrial disease. And they found some mixed things. They found that overall, there was an improvement in the number and function of the mitochondria in patients with mitochondrial disease, as well as, you know, the individuals they had studied previously who did not have mitochondrial disease. So that led to a whole new area of questioning of whether we should be encouraging patients to exercise or participate in some modified activity. So backtracking a little bit, we know that exercise does requires a number of physiological steps. It requires the delivery of oxygen and nutrients to the muscles, and it exercise improves the muscles' ability to utilize oxygen efficiently. And it also improves the muscles' ability to break down nutrients and use those effectively for muscle activity. And the ability of the muscle to, it improves the ability of the muscle to generate energy in an efficient way. So, and we know that, and we all know that just from if you get somewhat out of shape, it takes more effort for you to do a general activity than when you are in shape. And then oftentimes you can feel that you're working harder at it and also taking deeper breaths or requiring more oxygen. So, there's been a number of different studies now that have been taking place since 2001 up until 2007, most current research, looking at endurance exercise and resistance exercise, and whether one is better than the other, whether they're both beneficial to patients, and is there any negative side effects. And what they found was that number one, there needed to be a lot more research because they're only looking at very small patient populations when they do these studies, like 14 or 15 patients in a study, and sometimes a little bit more, but still the numbers are quite small. And they found that overall exercise does improve mitochondrial function and number, and that they became very specific looking at not only the healthy mitochondria, but also not so healthy mitochondria, making sure that to try to determine whether the number of mitochondria that increase were the healthy mitochondria, also known as wild mitochondria, were increasing over the unhealthy or mutant-type mitochondria. And they found that in some studies, actually both increased. But the feeling was that even though some of the mutant mitochondria may have increased, that it seemed to disperse more and not to have a negative clinical effect on the patient. And they found that when they did a couple of studies, one study that they had patients trained for 14 weeks, they actually found an improvement in the ability for the muscle to take up oxygen and to improve the capacity for the patient to work with and increase their exercise tolerance. So, and then when they further studied those same patients, if they kept exercising beyond the 14 weeks of the study, they actually maintained the benefits they had and exercise tolerance, whereas if they didn't keep up those the training, they actually lost the conditioning that they had gained. And in one study, they actually found they looked at the muscle tissue and actually biopsied it again and found that there actually was an increase in mutant or deficient fibers in the muscle that indicated that the respiratory chain was more affected. So there's actually been some significant studies to say that endurance-type exercises like walking or swimming and things like that actually does improve mitochondrial function. There's also been some studies on resistance exercises like leg lifts and kind of short muscle contraction type exercises, and they are also positive in leading to believe that there's an improvement in mitochondrial function, but the research in resistance exercises seems to be less research in this area.
So, Margaret, what would you say about people who feel bad when they exercise? Because that's the reason I think that it was the record that
I think that
do that in the past.
That's a good question. I mean, we just like with for people that are that do not have mitochondrial disease, the recommendations for the average population are not to exercise to the point of pain or extreme fatigue. That would be the guideline for mitochondrial patients as well. And with extreme caution given to you build up your tolerance very slowly. And so patients that feel that don't feel well, even with the with minimal exertion, would be best advised to if they wanted to try to increase their exercise tolerance through activity, to do it in a controlled situation, either with a physical therapist or some person that's skilled in that area. But and some people are probably not going to feel great if they haven't exercised for a while. It would have to start off very slowly for some people that have had to limit their activities significantly.
There's an And everybody, just do me a favor so we can hear well. If you have any kind of background noise, just press mute on your handset so that we don't hear the background noise, but you can still hear us. Is there a theory, Margaret, that a person with mitochondrial disease should exercise and then expect to have a period of rest to recuperate after the exercise?
Most likely, patients are going to need to take some drugs. I mean, even though we are suggesting that patients try to increase their activity level, pacing the day is still a very important part of managing the symptoms of mitochondrial disease. So, yes, I would schedule a rest period into the day after the activities and possibly, you know, a time to drink and replenish fluids.
Great.
Does that answer the question?
It does. And I would, is there more you'd like to talk about, Margaret, or should we open up for some comments? I'm sure the group has some questions for you.
I think we can open it up. I mean, I think if I haven't covered everything, some of the questions should address that.
Great. And I'm going to ask, again, whoever has a little bit of background noise, it sounds like some banging and maybe some kids, and we can all relate to how that happens in our everyday life. But if you'll just press mute there for us so that we can hear. It's just difficult when there's this many people on the phone to hear with any kind of background stuff.
You know, I think the biggest take-home message from this is that contrary to maybe past recommendations that people have heard of the need to, you know, to have a more inactive life, I think the research is showing now that activity is important. It does improve the quality of life and physical capacity, and improves not only muscle function, but also, you know, the brain clearness and ability to think more clearly, and that's been shown in both the patients with mitochondrial disease as well as in the general population. So I think overall it's a positive thing to have some modified routine exercise in your life, and I think it should be monitored closely, especially at the beginning, by a therapist or someone that's skilled in that area. We do have one kind of interesting, we have a 16-year-old girl who lives in Massachusetts who was very, very sedentary, and now she's on a treadmill for about 45 minutes every day, and she feels great. So it's pretty amazing what they can...
What's her pace on the treadmill, Margaret, to help translate that to people who are thinking about the reality?
I mean,
I'm imagining that she's walking, she's not running, right?
Right, she's walking on a treadmill. I don't think a treadmill is the recommended... recommended way to go for probably a lot of patients, especially because it's hard in the joints and for people that haven't been able to exercise routinely on a regular basis, it's kind of a tough way to start, one. And two, you know, I think, you know, everybody's going to have their own goal of what they can achieve, and it's very individualized. And, you know, working closely with a therapist and starting out slow with just regular exercises and then, you know, gradually readjusting your goal to what you can tolerate is important. But I would not say your New Year's resolution has to be to, you know, walk a mile a day.
Before I open the field up for comments and questions, there's also some talk in these studies about the baseline, you know, of maintaining a baseline. And would you talk a little bit about what that means, Margaret?
I think the let's see, how do I phrase it? I think, you know, each individual has to work with their physician and or therapist to determine what's a realistic goal for them. And then to achieve through exercise and to try to maintain that baseline, achieving a baseline is what kind of a level at where you feel good, like where your body is not uncomfortable or you don't feel so fatigued, but to be able to maintain that baseline of activity or well-being. We know that fluctuates all the time. It fluctuates with everybody in the population and their baseline based on the demands in their life, based on emotional stress, physical stress, illness. So that's going to wax and wane. And so it's expected that, you know, there may be times when you can't keep up an activity or you kind of take 2 steps forward and 3 steps back and you have to get back on track. But, you know, perhaps the bringing a little bit more routine activity into your life will improve endurance and help reduce stress so that there's fewer setbacks in maintaining the baseline.
Great. Thank you, Margaret. And Margaret, you've done a great job summarizing those very scientific studies and bringing this to very relevant information. So thank you. I'm going to open the floor and we'll take questions because we're not all together where you could raise your hand. We'll just have to kind of be patient with one another. So, but I'm sure several of you who have experienced directly with your children or yourself have questions. So who would like to ask a question? Okay, Raya?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm interested in what you were saying about the, I can't remember what you called it, but basically I think it's anaerobic exercise or strength training, because I've been able to build up some reasonable capacity for somewhat aerobic exercise, boxes and things like that. But every time I try even the slightest, I even went into a post-polio program, even though I don't have polio, I have really limited muscle strength, and it radically increased my pain level. So I don't seem to be able to get anywhere in the strength training at all. Would you have any thoughts or recommendations on that?
Christy, can you repeat some of that because I couldn't hear the whole thing.
Sure. So that's Raya, and she's an adult patient. She was very active trying to actually fix her mitochondrial disease with exercise and then was found that it was actually too much. And so she's trying to find a balance and was saying that the anaerobic exercise, which i.e. the strength training or resistance training, gives her increased pain, even with a very minimal level of resistance. And so she's asking if you had any thoughts or recommendations about that.
So improving tone with resistance exercising?
And being able to do the exercise without experiencing the pain. Or is there a, you know, what are your thoughts about whether that means that aerobic exercise is just as good as the resistance exercise if you're not able to do both?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. I think, and this may be partly that aerobic exercise is more researched in the mitochondria population than the anaerobic or resistant type exercising. And there's some patients that have low muscle tone, it's going to take a lot more work to improve that, and it may not be entirely possible because of the muscle pain that occurs with the resistance exercises in an effort to improve tone. If you find that you're suffering from pain with resistant exercises, it probably is best to consider aerobic or, you know, the endurance types of exercises and improve your strength and or endurance that way, because I think it gets, if you're exercising to the point of pain or it's not taking, you're trying to exercise and you're really not being able to exercise much at all with exacerbating some pain, then it's probably, it could be detrimental and actually, take steps back in the training. So, I guess, is there someone that can, is there a physical therapist or someone that monitors you through this or a rehab physician? What are their thoughts on this? Do they see that you're uncomfortable with,
I should just stop the strength training because it was hurting me and they weren't sure if I am doing okay with some of the aerobic work, but I guess every now and then they think, wow, it really would be nice to get that neck of yours a little stronger or something like that. And I don't know, it sounds like erring on the side of caution with the things that are causing pain is so good.
Do you feel like you're making some improvement in the muscle tone?
I feel like my muscle tone is really good. I do. I mean, I'll just never be a fashion model. What can I say?
Right. And your goal can't be, may not be able to be what somebody else who doesn't have mitochondrial disease, but if you're feeling good and you're... muscle tone has improved. That's great. Now, do you find that you have less, it takes more to exacerbate pain than it had before you started exercising?
I've been exercising most of my life, except for a few years when I was totally bedridden.
Do you have pain when you do the resistance training?
Yeah, a lot.
And a lot of pain?
Uh-huh.
Does it take more exercising to start the pain, or is it about the same? Like if you exercise for 10 minutes, do you have pain?
Yeah.
And does the pain come on as early in the exercise routine as it did when you... like, say, a year ago when you were exercising?
Well, I dropped it, but when I was doing it, yeah, it actually came on earlier and earlier. When I was over with the routine, it never went away until I dropped the routine completely.
Right. If you're feeling good with, if you're overall feeling good after you exercise, it's probably okay to keep exercising. I think you just have to be careful about how much pain you subject yourself to and, not making it intolerable and causing, muscle damage. I guess that would be the concern that you'd want your therapist or rehab physician to monitor.
Yeah, like if it's darky and brown, you gotta worry.
Other questions from the group for about the topic?
I have a question. This is Susan.
Uh-huh.
From West Virginia. My son Ian is 2, and he turned 2 in November, and he is he started crawling about the same time he turned 2, which we're delighted because we have mobility. And he crawls around in sort of an adaptive crawl. It's more like a hop. It kind of reminds me of a little bunny, but he's everywhere now, and I'm really grateful for that. My question is this. It seems, and his physical therapist gave me this language, this is not my own, that it seems as though he presents with pain at the eccentric control of his muscle. Mm-hmm. Like a good example of this would be he can pull up and stand, but when he goes to sit down, it brings him to tears. And anybody that's an adult that's experienced this or has any tidbits of help, because it's really preventing the whole walking thing, because he's, it's not, I don't think the walking itself is what is fatiguing him. It's the actual getting up to stand and then knowing he has to sit back down.
Can I ask a quick question? Just because my son's two,
yes.
And is very similar on the development curve there. You know, he's crawling, turned two in December, and is just learning to pull himself up on the tables as well. We found that he was crying when he was standing because he didn't know how to get down without really flopping down and basically banging his butt. And every once in a while, he'd also bang his chin. Because he didn't have the motor skills. He could pull himself up, but he couldn't figure out how to get down. So what was happening was he was, after sort of, you know, banging himself a couple of times, he'd sort of get up and then realize that he didn't know how to get down. And he was crying more in frustration than he was in pain. He was crying more in frustration. So are you absolutely convinced that it's muscle-related pain?
It wasn't even my convincing. It was actually a physical therapist convincing, because he also, when he first started trying to learn how to crawl, he could push up into crawl position, but to get back down, that transition, that slow transition, rather than just flopping down, it just really visibly appeared to hurt him. And it's kind of across the table. Any eccentric control of his muscle brings him pain. But crawling, he's crawling incessantly and just all over the place and doing fine with that and doesn't fatigue. But it's that transition to sitting back down, or he has adapted his crawl to where he doesn't have to go back down to the floor. He kind of transitions to a butt sit. And I was just wondering, for the good of the group, I mean, if anybody that's older, that's experienced, has anybody experienced the same type of sensation with the eccentric control of the muscle?
Yeah, this is Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
I experienced it. Again, I was active in team sports and endurance exercise, from elementary school on up until the MITO stuff started happening. What I noticed when the MITO was getting worse was that, say, I'd be walking home from work, and I would feel like I would have a cramp coming on in my calf muscles. And that's scary, because cramps hurt. But then what would happen instead is I'd lose control and, I'd start doing the foot drop. And that's one of the things that led me to get an assistive device, because to the outsider, I appeared to be drunk. I'd end up staggering. It might be that, and spasms are painful too, but they're different from cramps. Every once in a while when I overexercise, one or both of my feet will go into spasm. But, I'm kind of wondering, maybe he's experienced cramps in the past, and it feels like one's coming on, and it's scaring the daylights out of him.
Right. Has anything that you've done been beneficial with regards to that sensation? I mean, is there anything you can do to keep that from being so painful?
Well, the key is to stop pushing beyond my personal limit. And again, I want to thank Margaret, because you answered a question that I had, and that's that baselines do change. I have now twice worked up in the pool to where I was doing quite well, and I caught a virus, and I had to give it up for a while because you know, when I tried to exercise again, I was short of breath, the heart would pound, and I was just chilling miserably. And that's happened to me twice. So, again, but I would like to say, too, that I don't know how applicable it is to the younger children, that I find that just being immersed in water, especially warm water, takes away a lot of the pain. It's like I can relax. And, like, I have joint pain and muscle pain.
It's my son's favorite place to be.
Yeah, and maybe that would help the kids because, you know, that just having that little vacation from pain. And the other thing I wanted to add is some of the people that have already engaged in aerobic exercise, you know that runner's high that you get? And I found that with, like, maybe half an hour or 45 minutes workout with very gentle exercise in the pool, like the stuff that the 80-year-old ladies do for arthritis.
Right.
Okay. I get that effect. I feel tired when I'm done, and I need to go home and rest and eat. But that thing where you feel that glow and you don't notice the pain will last up to 45 minutes, sometimes an hour. And, again, I have had nothing that actually helps with pain control other than taking a lot of prednisone. So that's something else that I think, I don't know if there's any research on it, but just doing appropriate exercise I think has a lot of potential for controlling pain.
Is your son taking any supplementation at this point? Oh, yes. He's on megadoses of CoQ10 and creatine and Carnotaur and B1 and 2. He's also on MCT oil. Dr. Schaffner has got him on a pretty high-potency cocktail.
Right. Margaret, would you have anything to add about the discussion, particularly with experiences you've seen with your own patients in regard to children who are experiencing pain as part of their physical therapy and benefits of warm water exercise and so forth?
For children in regards to physical therapy, and what was the last thing?
Pain, and perhaps if you've also seen some benefits of the warm water exercise.
We have patients that have pain when they exercise, and then some that are not experiencing discomfort. It's a lot of this is individualized. What the activities that we found that people have, that children have done well with are swimming and some water activities because they're not weight bearing and, you can in some ways pace yourself that way. As for, the other things that patients have participated in, really successfully are therapeutic horseback riding, and those have been probably swimming and horseback riding have probably been the two biggest areas that kids have participated in routine exercise and activities. As for pain management, it's very individualized. We've worked with pain therapists and on various types of pain management, whether it's conventional medication to acupuncture and biofeedback and other forms of medication and other forms of treatment. I think this is a huge area that needs to be explored a lot more for patients, adults and children with mitochondrial disease, but I think probably the things we try to steer away from, and we're not the ones recommending the pain medication most of the time, is to try to stay away from narcotics because of the dependency aspect of it and the chronic nature of mitochondrial disease, but to look for alternative ways. And also by increasing, like, vitamin therapy to optimize the mitochondrial pathways and to improve function. But, you know, as far as pain management, I think it's something that needs, it's one of those areas that needs to be explored significantly, but an individual approach is really pretty much the way we handle most of our patients.
Thank you, Margaret. Other questions for Margaret?
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
If I'm thinking right, these studies were done on mitochondrial patients that have mitochondrial DNA defects. My defect is a nuclear defect, which affects the DNA polymerase gamma, which is responsible for the replication and maintenance of mitochondrial DNA. Are these guidelines applicable to me also?
So are these studies for the...
Are these generalized to all mitochondrial disease patients or only the types of mitochondrial mutations studied?
These are mostly on mitochondrial DNA testing. You know, the recommendations that have been made are for... the general mitochondrial patients, but the studies have been on more with patients with nuclear DNA mutations, but it's been generalized to believe that exercise and is probably ways up. The benefits of exercise outweigh the risks of a sedentary lifestyle. The patient populations are very small that they're working with. So, there is a recommendation for more studies to be done to confirm that the benefits are to try to better understand the response to exercise in, depending on the type of mitochondrial disease and DNA mutation, but these are smaller type studies that are looking at a small patient population, but the overall recommendation from the studies done from 2001 up to now, the multiple small population studies pretty much are stating the same thing, that the benefits of exercise are outweighing this a sedentary lifestyle.
Thank you, Margaret. Other questions for Margaret?
Yes, this is Lisa from Bolton Landing. Margaret, I have a problem with trying to set guidelines. Initially, when I was diagnosed, I had a physical therapist that was sent to my home to see what they could do to help me, and all my life I've exercised, and so they said, well, you know everything to do. I really can't say anything more. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was that I didn't know how much to do, when to stop, how far to push myself, and I made the physical therapist very uncomfortable because he wasn't accustomed to dealing with someone who was constantly getting fatigued, and every time we would try something, it would set me back, and I would actually feel sick and have to stop for a few days because his guidelines and goal setting were not typical for, I guess, what this disease needs to work with. I don't know how much to push myself and when to stop and what type of goal is a reasonable goal. Is it, can my goal be similar to what it used to be, where I would continually be able to increase my distance and endurance, or is there a more realistic type of goal to look for? And if I feel out of breath, do I, after doing just next to nothing but trying something, do I try to grit my teeth and push myself, or am I harming myself?
Now, so your question is that your physical therapist doesn't have a lot of experience with individuals with mitochondrial disease and the fatigue issues that go along with it. And so you're both kind of trying to figure out how far to push yourself. Is that right?
Yes. He left the case because he said there was really nothing he could do for me, so I have none. But that is what I was asking, yes.
Are you it's your symptoms are mostly fatigue, or do you have pain as well?
Mostly fatigue. If I do the resistance, there is some pain involved, but it's not to the extent where I would be willing to stop. I'm able to keep going. But I get my diaphragm muscles weakened, and I get fatigue and out of breath pretty quickly.
Do you feel that your stamina has improved at all?
It does, and then I feel as though if I've done my aerobics for a couple of days in a row at I think a very reasonable low pace, then all of a sudden I just give out, and it's 3 or 4 days of not doing anything before I feel as though I can walk a short distance down the road again.
Would or has your physical therapist consulted with other therapists or people that may be able to, that have worked with patients with mitochondrial disease?
I did discuss that with him. It's been a year since he's been here, when I was first ill, and he said he knew no one who had mitochondrial disease.
Where do you live?
I'm sorry?
Where are you from?
I live in northern New York, in Bolton Landing.
In Woburn? In Massachusetts?
New York.
New York, okay. I mean, I think perhaps it would be useful for your therapist to get the articles that Christy talked about making available to the group, and also, consulting with someone in, one of the medical centers that follows patients with more patients with mitochondrial disease, because it's hard for me to say whether or not you should readjust your goal and try to maintain where you're at, or to try to improve your stamina without knowing you firsthand. But I think if your therapist probably could make those recommendations with a little bit more understanding of what the general expectation is from a physical therapy standpoint. So there's a couple of rehab physicians at New England Medical Center, and there's probably people at Mass General in the Boston area that could speak to your therapist, and we could give them that contact information if he wanted to make that contact, as well as providing him with some literature.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Could I make a suggestion, too, or ask a question? Have you tried, doing your exercise program with at least a day of rest in between?
No, I haven't. I think I should do it daily. No.
Oh, well, I kind of lucked into that. My exercise schedule was set by the YMCA schedule. So I was, going in, Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, and I think that day in between to rest up really helped.
Okay.
I mean, it's worth a try.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's better than crashing.
Any other questions for Margaret?
Yes.
About this excellent topic? Go ahead.
This is Jenna from Illinois. My daughter does not have a definitive diagnosis. I guess that's probably not a shock to anybody here. But I actually have a question as far as her going to her occupational therapist, where we were also at today, and trying to recognize some of the signs that maybe it's too much feed of occupational therapy, and they have her trying to do some arm strengthening for low tone and that kind of stuff. And I've noticed on a couple of occasions that she comes out a whole lot paler than she went in, I'm seeing, and on a couple of occasions she's come back and I noticed, I don't know if it was her muscle fatigue or what, but shaking her arm. So I'm wondering if I should ask her, to tone it down something. Basically we're coming from the standpoint where if there's no harm in treating her as if she does, have this disease, then it's not going to hurt anything until we figure out.
How old is your daughter?
She's 3 and a half.
3.5 hours.
She's high functioning for the most part, you know, physically. She can walk and stuff.
Right.
So
you're saying that after she does activities, you find that she's often shaking and...
Well, yeah. I mean, the muscle, you know, that's been used. Well, I guess it's the color changes that I've always, you know, her early intervention therapist she had before would always just, you know, stop when she had a color change because we kind of thought maybe that wasn't a good thing. But, you know, if there's no harm in it, you know, I obviously want to... You know, she hasn't had any major consequences. Last winter, she wasn't doing as well and had some major consequences where I would have problems finding her oxygen levels really low after having a day. You know, I mean, really low as in not really low compared to some people, but, you know, hanging out right on that threshold around 90%, you know, or having little apnea periods when she overdid it. And I'd really like to not go back to that.
If she's shaking post-exercise, her particularly in the muscle with the muscles that have been exerted, that's probably too much. And it could be looked at in a couple of different ways. I mean, sometimes in addition to general exercise and improving your stamina, the other things that need to be taken into consideration that also will contribute to stamina are in nutrition and hydration. And sometimes patients are more vulnerable to exercise intolerance if they're not well hydrated or they're not able to take in adequate hydration.
She has a G-tube, so we have that.
Okay, so she has...
She's gotten the hydration.
And she's well hydrated and well...
She should be. And what I've noticed is now when we come home from therapy, I give her Smarties, which are basically pressed dextrose. And that seems to help a little.
Right. I mean, some patients with mitochondrial dysfunction require more hydration than the average individual of the same age and height and weight. So, you know, ensuring that she's well hydrated based on her urine-specific gravities and things like that would be useful in knowing. But in general, I would say that if she's shaking afterwards, she needs to be monitored closely when she's exercising to not get to the point where she's over-exerted herself. And it may take longer for her to... build up to stamina level, because especially where she's only 3.5 and, you know,
and she doesn't know when to stop, so.
Yeah.
And does anybody else, I'm sorry, I hate that, one more general question. Does anybody else find a difference between in them or their children between their functioning in the summer and in the winter? She seems to do a whole lot better in the summer than she does in the winter.
That goes for adults, too.
Okay.
I mean,
she can handle a lot more exercise and a lot more activity in the summer than she can in the winter. For some reason, you know, half hour sometimes, and she's just...
Mm-hmm. I mean, autonomic dysfunction plays a part in this, too, and a lot of patients are just the opposite, having more difficulty in the heat. But there are some patients that, for various reasons, that do seem to have better, more stamina and... in general, better health in the warmer weather. You'd have to look at kind of her big picture and know her, all her different organ function and symptomatology to be able to best address this question. But, because I don't think for the most part we know that we see patients have seasonal variation in stamina and function, but it's hard to be able to say exactly why that is other than, you know, the autonomic in the body's regulation.
She does have a history of autonomic issues.
She does have a history.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One thing.
I have a question for the mom of the little girl that's 3. What are her blood sugars like?
to neither extreme, but sometimes very low. I know it doesn't say anything.
Does she go low? Is she hypoglycemic?
She's never been ridiculously low that we found.
Okay.
No, well, actually, sometimes she's been, you know, fairly, I mean, you know, moderately high. I don't think she's ever been below, like, 85.
Okay.
So,
well, you're going to Cleveland? Is that where you're going?
Oh, no, we're not going anywhere. We're at a dead standstill.
Oh, okay. Dr. Cohen is one of my son's doctors at Cleveland Clinic, and he regulated characteristic of some mitochondrial diseases, especially my son's, is there's a problem, especially for fatty acid oxidation problems, there's a problem with regulating blood sugars and keeping your blood sugar constant. And one of the things that was recommended to us before bedtime is just some cornstarch added to his food, which I don't know what it does. But Dr. Cohen made that recommendation at Cleveland Clinic. But anyway, it's been very helpful. It keeps him. He also is on a free amino acid food, Neocate.
Yeah, he still takes Neocate. Yeah.
Yeah, it saved his life. And so anyway, that's really helps with energy. Thank you for that extra discussion. Any other final questions for Margaret? We're going to begin to wrap up our discussion about exercise here. I think it was very helpful. Any other questions for Margaret?
Can I ask a really quick question?
Sure.
I don't know if there's anybody else here, but I have a problem with peripheral neuropathy with my mitochondrial disease because it affects my nerves, too. Do you have any recommendations on how to go about exercising with that?
Because it affects your nerves, too?
Yeah, I lost position and vibration sense in my feet, so I trip over my feet.
Because of peripheral neuropathy.
Because of your peripheral neuropathy?
Oh, yeah.
Are you taking medication for that?
Well, that only works for pain.
Are you taking medication for the neuropathy, or is it just pain medication that you're taking?
Well, that's Neurontin. That only helps with pain, though. That doesn't give me the feeling back.
Well, aren't you talking about having to regenerate nerve tissue to get improvement on that? Because that was one of my first symptoms, too, with neuropathy.
Does anybody else have a problem with that?
I think peripheral neuropathy is a very common problem, Jamie. So, Margaret, go ahead.
There's a couple of things. I mean, the neuropathy, I mean, it's, you know, can be treated with like Neurontin or some other medications like that. But some patients that have had neuropathy have found it was okay to be on a stationary bike and bike with it, and were able to the pain wasn't increased. The neuropathy pain wasn't increased with that, and they were able to tolerate that kind of activity.
Mm-hmm. So bicycling,
do you
think it would be the best thing?
I believe that's one of Dr. Cohen's recommendations in Cleveland, that he is very supportive of stationary biking because it doesn't require the same the same impact that walking or running or treadmilling requires, and you can get very good tone and muscle and strengthening in the form of bike riding. So it is a very good way to get exercise and probably more tolerable for patients with neuropathy.
Maybe less leg cramps too.
They don't discuss in the studies what type of exercise they use, other than resistance versus aerobic.
And I don't think in any of the studies they actually specify what type of activity they do. But I do know from patients and from talks that Dr. Cohen has given that he has recommended biking in the past, and most patients prefer to do stationary bike because they have more control that way.
Okay.
It's easier on your joints than, like, jogging and stuff, too.
Yeah, I was told swimming is the best, too.
And swimming, yeah.
Swimming and biking.
Actually, I found, like, rollerblading and cross-country skiing was easier on my joints than jogging, you know, when I could still do them. But running went first, and then bike riding, and then, you know, my sports just kept getting worse and worse, and they finally all disappeared.
But you have the 80-year-old aerobics, Kathy, so you're fine. Right?
Yeah. And those ladies are so sweet, too. And can I see as the youngest? I'm considered the baby.
Any other final questions for Margaret?
It's Marion in Toronto. Uh-huh. I'm wondering about an exercise program for a 9-month-old.
An exercise program for what?
A 9-month-old. Obviously, it would be passive range of motion, but should there be an exerted effort to extend that beyond, you know, 1 or 2 repeats or whatever?
I think, I mean, it, you know, up to what you can tolerate, but, you know, if you can do repeats for more than 1 or 2 sessions, you know, 1 or 2 motions, then you perhaps with, that would be beneficial to try to increase that over time and gradually.
Okay.
That what you mean?
He's very stiff, so you sort of don't know what you're really doing, but they can work at it.
I think I can speak to that. This is Susan. My son is now 2. He was in the diagnostic phase, and we favored it to be a mitochondrial disease at that age. And so we were really concerned about lactic acidosis, but our physical therapist very carefully began to develop a baseline for him and a regimen for him. And I would watch him really closely every day to see how much he napped. And if his napping became excessive, it meant that we pushed him too hard. And so we would back off the following day or the following time she came. And that was very beneficial to us. And so it literally is kind of as tolerated and watch the child because they'll sleep for extra energy. It'll zap them. So just add slowly and see how much your baby can tolerate.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, I think that's very good advice.
It's great to be able to learn from one another as well, isn't it? It's great to be able to hear the successes and experiences. And I think what's really neat is to be able to hear that sometimes what's happening for an adult patient might be happening just in a little different way in a child, but we can learn from one another even though we have years between us. You know, and I really appreciate that, and I appreciate that all of you are willing to, you know, kind of bear through each other's individual experiences and share your thoughts and experiences that help one another, because that is one of the best ways that we really can help one another. And I'd like to thank Margaret for taking time out of her day to spend this time with us and talking about this topic, which obviously is relevant and very much of interest to all of us. And the call has been recorded, so we will, again, like I said before, have it available as an MP3 file. And if you're anxious to have that right away, just shoot me an email, and I can send it to you, you know, directly. Margaret? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. I just kind of walked in on this.
Oh, sure. This is Christy Balcells. I'm the executive director. And I'll repeat my email address again because that will be helpful for you.
I have it on your phone.
director@mitoaction.org.
Right.
And you can find that on the mitoaction.org website also.
Yep, okay. Chris, can I ask you one question? My wife had just told me, I'm going on my way out, that there was something mentioned about Neocate?
Yes.
For energy?
We did mention that. Let me say goodbye to Margaret, and then I'll get right back to your question, okay?
Bye.
No, please, you're fine, and because I would like the folks who were talking about Neocate to talk to that. Thank you, Margaret, for your time.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me to participate.
Let's all say thank you to Margaret.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Margaret. Okay, have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and to get back to your question, I'm sorry, who was that asking me the question?
This is Mark Cubanville.
Okay, hi, Mark. So if you'll speak up, I believe a couple of the other parents were talking about me. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, my daughter uses Neocate. Actually, she uses the One Plus, which has more carbohydrates than fat, which seems to be better for gastric motility issues. Neocate is a formula for kids ages over one. It's just a formula. Complete can be used alone, kind of like Pedialyte. The only differences are it can be used for kids with multiple allergies, multiple protein intolerance. It's made of amino acids instead of the larger proteins. Amino acids are what proteins are made of. So it's broken down, and it's much easier to digest and derive energy from than other forms of formulas.
So all the energy is being derived from the amino acids?
Well, that's the protein form that's in it.
Well, I can speak to this. I feel like I should be a spokesperson for Neocate. I love it so much. It's my son's life. My son could not break down food into fuel, and it actually presented very much like a condition called very long chain fatty acid oxidation disorder, which is a huge bunch of words. But in a nutshell, everything I put in my baby, including my breast milk, it just seemed like a toxin. And everything I tried, it was just regurgitation and pain, and it was horrible. And our dietitian recommended Neocate infant, and he was approximately 9 months of age at the time, and he was a limp doll. And, I mean, he virtually was existing on no energy whatsoever. And we introduced the Neocate, and all of a sudden he is not having reflux anymore, and he was not presenting with pain at feeding. And amazingly so, he was beginning to hold his head up and doing all these things closer to what a six-month-old should do. And at that time, he was about 10 months of age. So it's a free amino acid, so he doesn't have to break down the you don't have to do anything to break it down. It's at its smallest form.
Right.
And
the protein is acceptable. You don't have to break down.
Does it have
carbohydrate, too? Is it something that...
It has carbohydrate and a fat source.
Okay.
Right.
So you can feed a child exclusively on
Neocate. Okay. Yeah.
How do you spell it?
N-E-O-C-A-T-E.
N-E-O-C-A-T-E.
And there's I guess there's an infant, there's a regular, and then there's a one plus.
Yeah, my son's currently on junior, which is two, and we found it very beneficial. And there's actually some flavors to the age two. It's kind of nice because it smells like a nice fish factory.
it's the three amino acids,
It's so
nasty. He's at the deal.
So my son has, and Ian does not have a G2. So, I mean, I don't know how in the world that child drank that down, but it was almost like he knew, hey, give me energy. I don't care. I'll drink it. But it smells nasty, but, I mean, they have different flavors, and he currently drinks tropical and loves it. It was like God sent him tropical, but he could not tolerate the chocolate. But anyway, yes, it's amazing. It's amazing, and I think everyone should know about Neocate. But it did give him energy immediately.
Oh, very good. Wonderful. Anyway, one more question. I mean, when you're talking about the amino acids, they're already broken down to their finest form, most usable form.
Right.
Does anybody know, and this probably goes a little scientifically, the cocktail consists of vitamin C, B vitamins, so on and so forth. Are they better if they're all in the active form, which is readily utilized by the body? And along that same line, I see that they've come out with ubiquinol, which again is the next step from CoQ10. Does anybody know, is that more beneficial than the stage above it?
Well, one thing, there were a couple people on the adult MITA group that experienced this too, and the main thing was that if you're taking the CoQ and carnitine, that it needs to be, there needs to be fat at the same time.
Right.
There were people taking CoQ and not feeling anything at all, and they just added a small amount of fat with it, and they suddenly got better results.
Right, I had my wife take like a teaspoon of peanut butter at the same time.
Yeah, and I think one of the people was having like ice cream or I think full fat yogurt with it.
Right.
My son takes MCT oil.
Right.
Yeah.
And
sometimes if you take a vitamin E capsule, it has enough soy oil in it to get the effect.
But I'm thinking because some of them made up now as a liquid cocktail. And when I was doing it before, I was using all of the bioactive forms. But I question whether if you have a CoQ10 deficiency complex 1, if you use ubiquinol, which is the active form, are you completely bypassing the CoQ10 stage, which it seems like you would because you're using the next stage. But I guess the question would be, do you need to have the CoQ10 form in order to help make the transfer?
This is Susan Swanson. I'm not even a doctor, but I'm saying CoQ10, the Peach Garden brand double strength has been amazing. It's been amazing transformation for my son. He's like the Energizer bunny, and I've learned real quickly, do not give it at night because he will be up all night clapping his hands, happy as a clam, as I'm sitting there sleepless.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it gives him lots of energy, and it's the most bioavailable form.
Right, okay, and like I said, with a complex one, the CoQ10, it doesn't transfer on certain ones, and I know that I had read prior that sometimes it has to go through that stage in order to get the benefit prior to it becoming its active form. But I just didn't know if it would make that transfer over. And I use the regular Q gel, but the liposomal versus the other.
Gene Shepard, who's one of our regulars on the Adult MITA group and the founder of the discussion list, she mentioned recently that there was there's somebody in Canada who's giving it clinical trials, and I think it originated in Australia or New Zealand, but there's supposed to be an altered form of coenzyme Q10 that's more easily absorbed.
Right.
I don't know if this is the same thing you're talking about.
My son is part of that trial.
Yeah.
It's really strange. But you can contact Case Western University, Dr. Kerr, in Cleveland, and that's where the trial is. That's part of where the trial's through.
What was the university?
It's Case Western University. That's one of the universities. Florida State is also doing it. But Case Western is who we're going through, Dr. Kerr.
Uh-huh.
And it's a CoQ10 study, clinical trial, government clinical trial, and it's four different universities are sharing it. And
well,
it's beginning right now.
Oh, okay, that's right. That was listed under one of the websites as
right.
Starting clinical trial.
See, the CoQ10 and then the one that they derived from the resveratrol, which is 1,000 times stronger, and they know that it does directly help the mitochondria.
I
don't
think.
So.
Yep, that is. I can't wait to find out about it.
Yeah, I think it was on the same page. I know in the travels, I just got done seeing it within the last couple of weeks. I thought it was on the same page that I read here where you're talking about the study and the clinical trials that are going on.
Yeah, Christy, is that something that's on the website now, that link to the clinical trials?
You know, I don't think it is, Kathy. Maybe we could work on that.
Let's look that up and try to make sure we get it on the website.
Let's work on that. I think that would be really useful. I also was going to mention that we had Guy Miller, who's the CEO of Edison Pharmaceutical, on the phone for one of these calls a couple months ago, because Edison Pharmaceutical is a company in California that is working on a CoQ10 derivative that is supposed to be more potent than the average CoQ10, even the most bioavailable form of CoQ10, which is currently the recommendation. their form is supposed to be a little different and absorbed and works a little better. And they're doing, I don't think they're at the human clinical trial phase, but I think that's happening this year. And he is a friend of MitoAction and will keep us posted on that. So whenever I hear anything from him, I will certainly pass it along in the newsletters, and so which you'll get as long as you're just subscribed on the website. So keep your eye out for that, too. That may be where it's ringing a bell for you also, because we talked about that a couple months ago, that there was a new drug, if you will, that was specific for mitochondrial disease. And he's actually doing trials with the CoQ10, which is something that is desperately needed for this patient population also.
One quick question. I got pulled away for a second. You were talking about more advanced CoQ10, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And what was the name of that the gentleman was speaking about? I'm sorry.
If you go to Tishon, where QGel is made, they have the regular QGel. Then they have another form. They have the ubiquinol, which is the active form. And then they have another form of the QGel. It's not QGel. It's another form of CoQ10, hydro something or other. I don't
know. Soluble.
Yeah. It's not the regular QGel, QSorb. But I know if you go to their site, they have two or three different ones that are available at this point in time, as well as they also make a
mitotonic.
Right, exactly. Although the amounts that are in there seem a little bit on the small side.
Mark, are you talking about the Tishon website or Epic for Health?
It ends up being about the same.
Okay, because just to simplify, Epic for Health, Epic, the number 4, health.com is their distributor. So,
right.
So usually in order to actually purchase it, you've got to go to Epic for Health. That's a little easier to know if you haven't heard of it before.
And I've also found that if you email Raj Chopra and you have questions about that, I know with me, he sent a huge box with one of everything to try it and see which way, which form seemed to work best for you. And one thing I found interesting at the same time, when I asked him, well, what would be the standard dose if you're going by pounds and a person's age, which have you? And his answer was, is you can't go based purely on that you have to go by clinical, whether or not, at what point does it make the person feel better? I don't know if there's an extremely high limit of CoQ10, and I haven't tried it yet. I'd find it.
Who's your metabolic specialist?
Who's my metabolic specialist? Actually, it's for my wife, and we're not using a metabolic specialist as much as neurogenetics, and that would be Dr. Sims.
Okay.
Well, something I just kind of rings a bell, but I think Tishcon was offering discounts for patients, but I think the UMDF members
they're on
discount at Tishcon.
Anybody with if you just let them know when you make your order that you have that you're taking this because of your mitochondrial disease,
right?
Then they give you a 5% discount,
right.
And I have some literature from them also that has their business card and all that kind of stuff. So if anybody would like me to mail them one of those, I'd be happy to. They were a sponsor of our awareness event this last year as well. So I have some stuff. You know, I don't have any samples, but I have some their brochure and literature. If you'd like that, send me an email at director@mitoaction.org, and I'd be happy to drop it in the mail to you.
Okay, Chrissy, I'm going to leave. If I do find that that connection or the information and the reserve trial that they talk about directly helping mitochondria, I'll send it to you.
Great. Thank you. And I think we're going to start to wrap up. Did anybody else have any other comments they wanted to share or connections they wanted to clarify while we're all on the phone together? Great. I want to thank you guys for all being here today and remind you that the first Friday of every month at noon is our toll-free conference call meeting, and the topic in February will be, I have a lawyer who can speak about your rights as a person having a disability, both for children and for adults, as well as some of the important steps in planning that you need to take when you're thinking about entering the world of disability advocacy and so forth. She's an advocacy lawyer herself. So I'll send more details about exactly what she's going to talk about later in the month, but that is our topic for the month of February, and that's the first Friday in February, again, at noon. And if you guys will, my favor that I ask for you to give back to what we're doing here is to help us to spread the word about the meetings to the other people that you know that have mitochondrial disease. There may be a perception that you have to, quote, be a member to be able to join one of these meetings. And I hope you get the sense from today that this is really just an open community. And our goal at MitoAction is not to try to get something from you, but it's to really try to give back in terms of resources and tools that you can use when you're living your daily life, either as a parent or as a caregiver or as a person who has mitochondrial disease. So help us spread the word about these meetings because it helps us to get that information out there and to help each other to get connected in this way.
Thank you.
And if you have any questions that I can help you with or ideas that you'd like to see happen, or if you're interested in really finding a spot where you can be more active, we welcome you, and we're small, and we hold hands together, and we kind of make our way forward. So just send me an email, and Kim, the president, and I are happy to try to get connected you and connect each other and to get each other involved, because we have this philosophy that being involved is a great way to cope with having a disease that otherwise leaves you rather helpless. So thank you, guys. Any closing comments or thoughts?
Yeah, this is Kim Lorimer. I just wanted to let everybody know I've been very quiet today, just listening. But I just wanted to say thanks to everybody for being here, and mostly thanks to Christy, who really does a fantastic job organizing these, coming up with the topics, and recruiting people to come speak with all of us. So I hope that you will be able to invite other folks to join next month, and I'm so glad to have gotten the virtual opportunity, at least, to have met so many of you. So thanks for being with us.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you very much.
Right, have a fabulous day.
You.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.